Hi, this is Craig, founder and programmer of Secret Movie Club. And today we were going to do Secret Movie Club Radio Hour Episode 4, but a few days ago in late October, we received at our headquarters here in downtown Los Angeles an unmarked envelope. And that envelope was a flash drive, and on that flash drive was a single file labeled capital MD underscore capital HH underscore 30.FLAC. Not really sure what that means. So I just called the team and I told them, look, I know we did all this work on Secret Movie Club Radio Hour Episode 4. I apologize. We're just going to, you know, put it in the archives maybe for another day. I'm just going to play this on Halloween. I really have no idea what's on it, which is really irresponsible for me to publicize it and throw it out on the airwaves. But sometimes you just got to roll loco, roll crazy, as Secret Movie Club team member Edwin Gomez would say. So this is our Halloween trick or treat. We have no idea for you, the audience. I'm going to put it on. We're going to upload it. We're going to click on it. We're going to listen to it. I hope not at our own peril. So enjoy or absolutely abhor all caps MD underscore all caps HH underscore 30.FLAC. And if you have any comments about it, you can always write us. We may or may not read them. We'll probably read them. Enjoy.
It is I, Mr. Devil, welcoming you to my 30th annual House of Horrors. Four tales of terror so frightening they will surely make you want to die. So gather round, younglings, gather round. Ah, yes, some people say I have a horror host job to support my gambling problem, but I like to say I have a gambling job to support my horror host problem. My therapist hates that one. Anyways, here's our first story, The Wheel.
I got it all cleaned up.
Sam motioned around the apartment. They had just had a housewarming party. It went very late.
Uh-huh.
What are you doing?
Oh, I forgot the bags and...
Eddie pointed to their dog.
We had one.
Just get it tomorrow.
If I wait till morning, I might forget it.
So?
Well, I know that whenever I step in dog crap, I curse the soul of whoever didn't pick it up. So. Plus, if I don't, I'll be thinking about it all night and won't be able to sleep anyway.
All right. See you in a few.
Eddie lived with Sam and the dog in a one-bedroom apartment in one of the nicer and more gentrified parts of the city. Eddie had never felt unsafe walking around, even this late at night. He'd had some strange encounters over the years. The time Eddie always thought of was when a considerably drunk woman had bent over to pet Rocky and, upon the dog's positive reaction, looked up at Eddie and asked if the dog smelled her vagina. But nothing had happened that ever truly shook him. At least nothing that wasn't his brain overthinking.
Yeah, and you like to do that. Out here like an idiot.
Eddie shook his head and his eyes drifted across the street. Fairly wide, though crowded with cars parked on both sides. The sidewalks were as nice as they could be, and there was a decent amount of green. The buildings were fairly old, and each had a short walk-up connected to the sidewalk by a few concrete steps. Eddie stopped and slipped a dog bag over his hand. With his other, he used the flashlight on his phone to search for his quarry. Once found, he snatched it, pulled the bag back over his hand, and quickly tied the top into a small, neat knot. Eddie started to head back. He was on the sidewalk across the street from his own apartment, and the block was empty, as it normally was this late. He started to think about the times he had gotten spooked being out here. He and Sam would watch a horror movie, and then he'd be out with Rocky, and suddenly he'd be certain that something slimy was waiting for him around the corner, or the echo of his own footsteps would come back to him. He'd turn, but there'd be no one. Or, worst of all, a car would drive by and slow down. Way down. Its window open, bottomless black inside, moving past Eddie at a mocking pace. The perceived emptiness of its cabin filled with all the real-life boogeymen Eddie could conjure. Manson, Gacy, Bundy, the Zodiac who had just come out of retirement and moved from the Bay and Eddie was to be his first comeback victim. Or maybe it was some sort of gang ritual, or a government op, or possibly—
Shut up. One more building, cross the street, throw the bag in the trash, then I'm home.
He started to focus on the cracks in the sidewalk. He'd step over them, lengthening and shortening the size of his step to avoid them. Eddie smiled to himself. Here he was, out at this hour, picking up dog poop just so someone else wouldn't step in it themselves. What goes around comes around, he thought, visualizing a giant wooden wheel. And he had just taken something off it. He'd be fine. He was protected. and almost home. He turned across the street and...
Excuse me.
Eddie stopped and looked. There was a man sitting on the steps that led up to the building opposite Eddie's. He was about 10 feet away, wearing a dark, tattered suit with a wide-brimmed hat that was tipped down over his face, hiding his features.
Do you know what time it is?
It's, 3:30.
No. Do you know what time it is?
Eddie paused. He looked over the man once more. He was thin, and while it was hard to tell exactly how tall he was because he was sitting, he seemed quite large, and he was barefoot. Eddie couldn't believe he didn't notice that until now. His feet were so pale, they looked like they glowed in the dark.
I'm sorry, man. I'm tired. I'm about to head to bed. I don't really...
Do you like to play games?
What?
Games.
He smiled, his grin two rows of slanted tombstone teeth.
Do you like to play?
Eddie's mouth felt dry. His breathing grew labored. One of his hands, the one still wrapped around his phone, was becoming unbearably sweaty. This didn't feel like irrational panic. This felt like the time Eddie thought he might have a heart condition. This felt like danger.
Like video games? Or sports?
Chance.
Eddie wanted to run and scream, but he was frozen.
What about a riddle, then?
The man finally tilted his head up enough to reveal his eyes, dark spirals caught inside dead glass marbles. Eddie glanced behind the man. A window was open, the curtain inside blowing in and out to the rhythm of Eddie's own breathing. He didn't know whose apartment it was, but he could smell something. Copper. And something else.
Say there's a man who wants to die, but he can't go through with it himself. So, every day, he prays for an accident to happen. And yet, it never, ever does. Not his whole life.
His smile widened.
Is he lucky or unlucky?
Eddie couldn't comprehend the question. He was too busy noticing little details. The dirt under the man's broken nails, his crooked nose, the blood on his collar. Eddie felt himself drifting away from where he stood. Big, deep fear welled up in his chest. Images floated past. The man with his hand gripped around a blade and plunged into the stomach of a vagrant. The man creeping into the open window of a large, extravagant house. The man spying on a woman as she undresses. The man suffocating a child, burying cats and mowing over them, eating flesh, pillaging, defiling, raping, killing, ripping, tearing. Eddie blinked. The man was still sitting down about 10 feet away, smiling.
Hey, man, I'm sorry. I'm tired and drunk, and I really have to go.
He stepped back, daring to twist his head and look away.
You forgot something.
Eddie halted, and then, carefully, he turned his head back and saw the man gesturing to something near his own feet. The bag of dog crap. Eddie thought for a moment about walking over.
It's... fine.
Eddie continued home. The man's smile somehow grew wider. Eddie didn't sleep that night. He stared up at the ceiling, light reflections from a malfunctioning streetlight arcing up over the top of his curtains, bounced across the old plaster, making an alien pattern. Eddie would never tell anyone about the man, though he was certain upon meeting some people for the first time that they already knew. Eddie turned onto his side. Sam and Rocky were cuddled up, warm and peaceful. They hadn't met the man. Not yet, at least. Eddie pictured the wooden wheel again, but this time color filled it out in alternating shades of black and red. It spun, a white ball insanely bouncing in and out of little slots created by the small wooden bits between them. But the bits weren't wooden. They were made of the man's teeth, and the ball, now the same ghastly yellow color, bounced across the wheel, making a sound like bones rubbing against each other. Eddie didn't know where it would land. He had no control. Never had it to begin with. He began to cry.
I think I met that man once, out on international waters. It's probably all I should share about that. Well, here's something about the water I can share. It's our next story, The Sleeping Mariner.
At first, I thought they were messing with me, but I looked deep down into the water and something was definitely moving. Something big. The first underwater rumbling woke me. I was in the middle of a nightmare about my grandparents' backyard in Thibodaux. Woke up to another nightmare. Hit my damn head on the upper berth. Ready to cuss them all out. They had a habit of all gathering at the shift change to piss off the side. It was breakfast or dinner, depending on your shift. There were just 9 of us. It was my damn right to take a nap instead of eat. Then the whole big rig rumbled. Great. Earthquake. Stumbled out into the hall. The damn smell of rust and decay and a decade of neglect had seeped into this relic of better times for drilling like arthritis. Like an old dog so crippled in the cold you just want to grab a shotgun and put it out of its misery. I guess that's what we were doing. Putting this rig out of its misery. Shutting her down. But no one was around. I stormed into the dining hall ready to tear them all a new one. I thought maybe the explosives guy, Rad or Rod or Ride or whatever that kid said his name was, had finally decided fire safety regulations really don't apply to the young. But no one was there. The remnants of the clown crew I got set up with was there. Plates, half-eaten eggs, cigarettes on the floor still smoking, ash in a long line like a dynamite fuse, vape pens tossed in the corner. God, that was weird. Didn't like that. And that's when the whole thing buckled. And I hit the floor and slid to the edge of the room. Into the girly posters Unicorn and North Dakota put out of women I'd never meet, holding industrial equipment. I gathered myself, grabbed rail like I was grabbing my ass in a firefight, went low outside and looked over the edge into the deep swirling void, an abyss they call the Pacific. Peaceful my ass. The ocean is a gaping maw of blunt death and murder and fear. Nature at its best, without the hussy makeup of a man-made myth trying to add eyeshadow to permanent darkness. I hated the ocean. That's why I worked on it, to remind me what a horror show it all was, and to get away from people. I hated people. At least sharks have the good sense to be sharks. People prance around pretending they're angels, then sleep with each other's spouses, rip off whoever they can. Whatever. Some French fop said we're insects devouring other insects in a trough of mud. Exactly. I'm sick even talking about it. Life isn't worth the air it's written on. And I thought these jokesters, these 20-year-olds, and the engineers who were little better were messing with me. But I looked over the edge and I saw it. Something huge, with slithering huge moving arms the size of New York City blocks, wrapped around the columns of the rig. Squeeze, tear it, yank it. And the poor thing cried out, crumpled more, listed 5 more degrees and fell 10 more feet. And I almost flew off. But I held that rail like I'd wrestled all my disappointments to the mat. That was my gift, or curse. Reflexes faster than my conscious thought. My body was always determined to keep me alive. Damn, at this rate I had 5 minutes. I looked one more time, and saw it. And my whole body froze in sudden, horrified, overwhelming shock. Cause it saw me. Its huge eye, bigger than some park, surfaced up out of that darkness. And saw me, and it pulled again. I ran to the comm terminal. I just accepted things and acted on them. My mom wasted hours in prayer, and the cancer still took her at 50. I'd rather talk to the mainland than get on my knees to chat with an imaginary friend. I grabbed the comm and spat out. Hey, Pack Drill. This is Operator Gus Broussard, badge number 5420. I'm on the Poppy. It's 0213. The rig is collapsing. We've got 5 minutes. 2 minutes. Make it 2 minutes before total submersion. We need air vac support. ASAP. Over. Hey, Pack Drill. Put down the effing phone. Stop Instagramming or tweeting or... Hey!
Pack Drill, Operator Jacob Meisner, badge number 6667. Please make your way to your enclosed life craft and sound the alarm. The alarm has been...
Oh, hell with it. They got the call. I saw the water rushing into the comm room. Sea level. I ran out again, but up this time. The whole rig was so far over it was like a 14-year-old puking at its first party. I wasn't gonna take the slide. I'd claw my way up the ladder, but it was hard. The floor was all wet. I kept sliding back, grabbing rail. I knew I shouldn't look back, but I looked back. Some sensitive nerve-filled tentacle end of something so massive the mind couldn't comprehend it slapped the steel walls. I screamed, or maybe a scream didn't come out, but I ran back out onto the platform. I could see the lights of Santa Barbara 5 miles back. Best dirty sex of my life. In a Ramada by Wyndham, of all places. Lucinda. Ah, hell. I didn't have time. Water was coming up over everything. I couldn't even grab a flotation device. There was an enclosed life craft 20 meters out. Then something came out of the water, encircled it, and crushed it viciously like a second-rate soda can. I couldn't even sound the alarm. What to do, what to do. Nothing was going to be topside in 30 seconds. The crane. Hell, I'd operated a crane. I could climb up to the cab. There had to be something up there. Or maybe I could fire it up and plunge the hook right into this thing's leviathan eye. And send it back to the depths from whence it came. So I ran. I wasn't going to go out without a fight. So I climbed and I clawed and put this thing out of my mind. I scrambled up the crane ladder like a damn squirrel in winter. Got to the cab door, pulled.
Save me, please! Save me! It stung me!
Why didn't you pull the alarm? Where's the... You need to drop the hook into its eye. Into its eye!
Something is happening to me right now.
Her skin was all oily and gray-green. Bile was coming out of her mouth. She lurched out at me to grab me, and I just fell back and slid back down that ladder like Jesus. Poor Fenny. I didn't know I had sympathy and mercy left in my shriveled old heart, but I did. Fenny was a new girl who had a bad relationship and just needed time. And look what God gave her. I was in deep water now, in with that thing. Its arm could grab me and pull me under at any moment, below the surface. I shuddered and froze for a moment, almost gave up, just waited. But something about Fenny, something about Fenny, something gleamed out of the corner of my eye. The moon or something caught it. One of the pick heads with a hickory handle was still in its damn place on the wall. In case of a fire, I scrambled, sloshed, broke the glass, grabbed it in my bloody hands, gripped it. It felt good. I could wield one of these things. Hell, I'd chopped firewood. My blood turned colder than the water. I turned and gripped the axe until my knuckles practically popped through my skin. Its arms were all over the deck, but so was something else. A million teeth arrayed in horrifying circles going all the way down a gullet. Like a tunnel into hell. It grabbed me. I tore that axe right into the meat of its arm. Shrieked. Released. I slid down towards that mouth. I tried to stop my slide, but who was I kidding? I wasn't gonna stop that slide. I hit something. It hurt. But it stopped me just 4 feet from this thing's mouth. And now it shrieked in some kind of foul vengeance. And I knew I had a one-way ticket into the bowels of that thing. And suddenly, something in me, I don't know what, something in me gave me the strength to fight. I raised the axe. I readied myself. Hell, I decided I'd jump in and start hacking away. And then something even more startling escaped my lips. I never thought I'd hear my lips form ever again. And I raised the axe. And I started.
Oh, the sea. A cruel mistress.
Speaking of the sea, I'm on the sea fog diet. I see fog and I'm reminded of the ephemeral nature of life and I tend to overeat.
Speaking of sea fog, here's our next story. Sea fog.
Silence. The infinite nothing that permeates when the only thing in any direction is open water and the only light is the moon. Charlotte sits on the deck of a blue fishing boat called Guthrie. The pristine condition of the vessel suggests it is quite new. An open notebook and magazine rests on her knees, commanding all of her attention as she focuses a small flashlight onto the page. She writes,
"What is the call that comes from days isolated on the water? To live in it, to die in it."
She looks up after a moment to take in the quiet before turning to two mounted fishing rods resting to her right on the side of the boat. The thin fishing lines occasionally catch the moonlight, pulled taut but undisturbed. Lures bob around a distance out. Returning to her reading, Charlotte picks up a pen and begins to make notes. The magazine article reads, "Charlotte Kinder and the War for Sustainable Fishing," with a headshot of Charlotte adorning the page. As she writes, the pale light on the water gradually unveils a dense, rolling sea fog, slowly pushing towards the boat. Charlotte stretches her arm out in front of her face and for the first time takes notice of the fog, which continues to roll in. She writes in her notebook once more.
"There's a heavy fog tonight. I can barely see my outstretched hand in it."
She shivers and finally moves her notebook and magazine onto the deck of the boat before drawing her knees into her chest for warmth. A sudden plop as the fishing lure disappears underwater, hidden by the fog. The fishing rod begins to bend at the tip, jostling Charlotte as she quickly turns towards it. She stands, pointing her flashlight into the fog, but there is nothing visible. The rod creaks on occasion as the line is pulled. She takes a step towards the rod, but turns back toward the interior of the boat, quickly reaching inside to snag a life jacket. As she does, the rod begins to arch further and further, and the Guthrie is slowly pulled with it. Charlotte latches the top strap of the life jacket and grabs the fishing rod, shifting her weight, digging her heels into the boat, and attempting to gain control of whatever she's hooked. She fights with the unknown entity, but struggles to continue reeling in, seemingly stuck. She bends her knees and falls back onto the deck, sliding her feet into the railing and pulls with every ounce of strength that she can muster. The line snaps. Charlotte curses under her breath. Lying on her back, she looks up to the sky, but the fog is so dense that not even the stars are visible. Reaching for her flashlight, she points it toward the area of her failed capture. Squinting her eyes at what appears to be a reflective surface, she sits up to focus, holding her breath as she does, attempting to see anything in the fog. For a moment, there is nothing. Then, the sound of something moving through the water. The bow of a larger ship cuts through the fog. Before she can react, it collides with Guthrie, forcibly sliding Charlotte overboard. Charlotte gasps for a breath of air as she comes up from the water, quickly whipping around to get a clear sense of her location. She sees the flashing side lights of the Guthrie and begins to swim in their direction, trying to stay calm as everything dips into darkness in between the flashes. An object interrupts the swim, a backpack. Pushing it out of the way, she presses on but notices a steel box floating in the ship's path. She swims towards it. A logo for Maritime Refrigeration adorns the side of the steel box, revealed to be a fish freezer by the blinking lights of the Guthrie that occasionally illuminate it. The freezer appears to be caught in a fishing net that's extending out from the ship. Charlotte spots another one ahead, the door swung open. Moving to investigate, she brings her face near the interior of the door. Scratch marks are everywhere inside. Fingernail scratch marks. She pushes away quickly in a panic, continuing towards her boat. As she finally approaches, exhausted, she grabs the side of her boat and shimmies around to a position that lets her pull herself up. She quickly recovers her flashlight and moves to investigate the damage, leaning over the side. A nasty chunk has been removed from the stern, but the boat doesn't appear to be taking on any water. Focusing the flashlight into the fog, she searches for the other vessel before catching the faint reflection of its hull. She looks for a second before moving inside. Charlotte closes her eyes as she ignites the Guthrie's silent electric engines, breathing a sigh of relief as everything comes to life. She activates and focuses a small spotlight towards what she can see of the other boat before moving the throttle slowly forward. The ship comes into focus, but the deck is still obscured by the fog. There are no visible lights or signs of life from the other boat. Moving the spotlight over the hull, she spots the name Katusa before catching the glimmer of a ladder resting on the side. She picks up her radio.
Katusa, this is Guthrie. Do you copy?
She waits, squinting through the windows into the fog. She presses her hand down on the horn, honking it several times. Nothing.
Katusa, this is Guthrie. Do you copy?
Again, no response. Charlotte thinks for a second.
Pan-pan. Coast Guard Radio. This is Fishing Boat Guthrie. I've been involved in a collision with what appears to be a purse-seine vessel called Katusa, who is not responding to my calls or horn. Please advise.
A voice responds.
Guthrie, this is Coast Guard Radio. What is your location?
Before she can answer, static emerges from the Katusa's radio line. Charlotte feels her stomach sink.
Katusa, this is Guthrie?
Nothing.
Guthrie.
Charlotte takes this in and snaps into action.
Coast Guard Radio, I will broadcast GPS location and emergency lights, but I am moving to board Katusa to investigate possible distress.
Charlotte does not wait for a response. She punches a few buttons on her controls and navigates Guthrie to become parallel with Katusa, matching its slow drift. She grabs a waterproof bag and removes a first aid kit, rations, and a flare gun before taking a rope from the adjoining wall and moving outside. The ladder slowly comes into clearer view as Guthrie glides next to Katusa. Charlotte carefully waits and times a throw, wrapping the rope around the bottom rings of the ladder and ties her into a cleat. Grabbing the ladder, she pauses to get her bearings. She places a hand over each of her pockets, confirming her gear is in place, and with one final breath, she begins to ascend. Flashlight in hand, Charlotte steps onto the Katusa. The steel frame of the boat creaks as it moves slowly through the ocean, large unseen equipment shifting in the dark. In the water below, the Guthrie's blinking emergency lights offer occasional moments of illumination ahead through the fog. Moving ahead slowly, Charlotte shines her flashlight from the floor to directly ahead of her in a deliberate pattern. She attempts to keep her breathing slow, despite the unease in her stomach. Scattered equipment and netting litter the deck. All at once, the putrid odor of rotting fish hits Charlotte. She swallows hard, fighting the urge to vomit, and pauses for a moment against a wall. Shining her light forward, she sees a staircase and takes it upwards. Each step through the fog gradually reveals an open door at the top. Charlotte stands in the entrance. She attempts to mask the panic in her voice as she speaks.
Hello?
No answer. Cautiously, she moves inside. The open door has allowed the fog to enter the bridge. Carefully moving to the controls, Charlotte begins pressing buttons, looking for any method to restore power to the vessel. But she has no such luck. Katusa is dead in the water at present. The bridge door slams shut behind her. Charlotte spins around, pointing her light at the entrance, but sees nothing. She holds her breath again, listening for any sign of movement. The creak of the ship is the only sound to be heard. Taking a brief pause to gather herself, she pushes on with careful steps, looking and listening for anything she can make out in the fog. At the door, she attempts to push it open with her back, staring into the bridge as she does. Taking another breath, she turns and kicks it open and quickly slams it shut behind her. Charlotte moves around the upper deck, gradually curving around the windows of the bridge until she finds another set of stairs leading up toward an observation deck. The deck is small and empty. She moves to look over the side and she finds the sea fog still obstructing her view. Removing the flare gun from her jacket, Charlotte points it into the air and fires. The red light of the flare ignites the sky. She looks for any answers in the deck below, but the fog still proves to be an obstacle. A massive crane appears slightly visible toward the bow. The crane is dramatically bent backwards, seeming to wrap around into the water, still holding a fishing net. As she looks, she spots a light moving slightly on the deck below her. She quickly moves back down the stairs towards it. Retracing her steps, Charlotte rounds a corner to the opposite side of the ship and spots the light once more. It moves gently from side to side, in time with the boat swaying. She approaches it and drops to her knees. Another flashlight. She picks it up to examine it. It's producing a more powerful beam than the one she's carrying, so she slides her own into her pocket. Making one more sweep of the area around her reveals more scattered equipment and the occasional dead fish. She takes a step towards the bow and the damaged crane. A cough, or something that sounds like it, echoes from Charlotte's left side. She turns to an archway that leads downward into the cabin of the ship. Hesitating momentarily, she moves down the stairs. It is pitch black in the cabin as she reaches the end of the stairs. The new flashlight penetrates the darkness and reveals a hallway with doors on either side. Approaching the first door on her right, she grabs the handle to open it, but stops as she hears the cough again, echoing further down the hall.
Hello?
She yells again.
Hello?
The slight, pained moan of someone responds. Turning her light towards the doors further down the hallway, she starts to move. She arrives at the stateroom door and pushes it open without hesitation. Her light finds a sickly-looking older man slouched on a bench. He puts his hands over his eyes to block Charlotte's light.
My name is Charlotte Kinder. Can you speak?
The man struggles to push himself upright. His left eye is swollen and dried spots of blood are spread across his body. His left arm appears limp.
Sure.
Charlotte places the flashlight on a countertop, facing it upwards to illuminate the room. She removes her backpack.
The Coast Guard are on their way. Can you tell me your name?
She places the first aid kit on the table in front of his bench.
Lewis?
That's a lovely name. Lewis, can you talk to me and tell me what happened?
Absolute chaos. Oh, we've been stranded for I don't know how long.
Did help not respond?
We didn't call for help.
Charlotte pauses for a moment at this response. She feels goosebumps on her arms. He stares at her.
What did you say your name was?
Charlotte.
Kinder.
Charlotte meets his stare.
Yeah?
Kinder Industries.
She watches him carefully, her movements tense.
The very same?
Lewis pauses on this revelation for a moment.
The force for change. I didn't ask for change.
Charlotte doesn't respond.
I like the old ways. So did my crew. Ah, look at us, operating like deplorables.
Change is predestined, Lewis. If you accept that, you can evolve with it. Either way, the world spins on without us. It doesn't matter what we do.
He ignores her.
You spend a lot of time alone on the water, Kinder.
Lewis moves his attention to the window.
Sure.
Once I was all alone, I just kept hearing this call. I wasn't suicidal. I don't regret what we did. It was just an invite from the water. To live there or die there, if I wanted. So welcoming.
I've gotten that invite too.
Lewis turns back to her.
I think I'd like to be left alone, Charlotte Kinder.
Charlotte studies his face. There's a calm around him. He adjusts his position to look back out the window again. Charlotte looks too. There's no visibility, only the fog. But Lewis is transfixed by it. She quietly begins to pack up her things and moves back toward the hallway. But she pauses at the door. She reaches into her bag and removes some rations and places them on the table. After a moment of hesitation, she also removes the flare gun and reloads it. She looks at Lewis once more, but his focus is unbroken. Walking down the hallway, Charlotte initially leaves the remaining doors untouched. But as she arrives at the first door she stopped at before discovering Lewis, she pauses. She cracks it open slightly, shining her light in. Obscured from view is a bed with two lifeless feet hanging over the side. She closes it again and moves to the stairs leading to the deck. Charlotte stands facing away from the Catoosa on the front of the Guthrie, looking out into the fog over the open water. She closes her eyes. A moment passes and she steps back from the railing. Searching the deck, she recovers her notebook and magazine. She sits down and focuses her flashlight onto them, pin at the ready. She turns and pauses, focusing on the Guthrie spotlight still aimed in the general direction of the Catoosa nameplate on the hull of the large ship. Her attention returns to her notebook. Behind her, a row of windows on the Catoosa are revealed through the fog. As the orange glow of fire lights up the interior behind the windows.
Ah, the sea. A cool. Didn't we already do this one already? Enough of this junk. Time for the really scary stuff. It's our last story. Night at the Club.
On a dark and temperate night in the City of Angels, at an independent movie theater that will hopefully exist for a while, six men gather. And why are they there?
Why are we here?
Four of them stand around the front area of the movie theater, like where you get your popcorn. The one in charge, Craig, replies first.
Well, there are two reasons. One, we need to make sure the place is safe.
Another, Connor, who looks sleepy.
Safe for what? From what?
Safe for the all-night sleepover movie marathon we want to play here. And from the murderer who's been going around killing people during all-night sleepover movie marathons in Los Angeles.
A third, Daniel, who we heard before.
Listen, I'm not about to become fast food for some film freak.
The fourth, Edwin, calmly.
Wait, Daniel. I'm sure Craig has a reasonable explanation. Besides, we should wait for our other two friends, Casey and Steven, who are in the back grabbing drinks, so we can inform them of the situation as well.
Thanks, Edwin. It's going to be okay. No one knows we're here. The second reason we're doing this, by the way, is because of this anonymous letter telling me that if me and five of my closest employees stayed the night at the club, we'd all get $10 million.
Seems fishy.
$10 million each?
If no one knows we're here, how could this properly test out the safety of the club?
Damn, the power. Listen, gang, let's cut through the theater and check on the others.
What a horrifying sight. Our two friends' dead bodies, mangled and twisted into a macabre tableau, too terrible to describe. Let's get out of here.
Maybe we should stick around and figure out who done it.
We already did that.
Maybe we're in a story right now.
We did that too.
Guys, I think we should listen to Connor. His knowledge of horror films, which I respect, leads me to believe he's the one with the right ideas.
Thanks, buddy. And just know, if this was a giant monster attacking us, you'd be the only one I'd turn to. Now, let's just get out of here. The longer we wait around, talking, chit-chatting, shooting the breeze, the more opportunities this killer is going to have to strangle, or tackle, or shoot, or stab us. See? Like right then. That would have been a great place for me to get shot. Right after I say, or shoot, boom, a gunshot rings out. Or after I said the thing about getting stabbed, if I then got stabbed, man, what a doozy that would have been, huh? I'm sure glad that it didn't happen and that it won't happen. Anyways.
A knife, stabbed in from the back, pops off the front of Connor's neck.
We should get going.
This slice goes through his cheek.
I think I'm still good.
And this one takes off his nose.
That one wrongly did it.
Behind Connor stands a hulking figure holding the bloody knife. His face is covered by a simple ski mask, and his nondescript clothes give no clue to his identity.
Ah!
Craig, Daniel, and Edwin run down the stairs, past the service elevator, and to the front door. But alas...
I won't open.
He locked it from the outside?
No, it's broken.
Did you know?
Yes, it's my fatal flaw, you see. I take on too much, and I'm bad at delegating. But if we just wiggle this around, it should...
And then, suddenly, swinging down from the empty elevator shaft next to him...
No!
A knife is plunged into Craig's head.
Come on, we'll try the window in the back. Let's get this thing open.
But then, from outside the window, a knife plunges into Daniel's stomach.
How'd he get out there?
But why you? You didn't do anything.
Don't you see? It's not about me. I can't be the final boy. It's you, Edwin. It was always you.
So, Edwin is stuck. A jammed door in the front and a jammed window in the back. Now he wanders through the theater room in between, unsure of what to do.
I'm unsure of what to do.
He looks up. The masked figure stands before him.
Oh, God! Why have movies forsaken me?
They have not.
Suddenly, an apparition appears before Edwin, angelic and radiating positive energy. They strike the murderer down and his body crumples to the floor.
I am the spirit of cinema, and no true believer will be harmed in this. A theater, the temple of film, under my watch.
But what about all those times that bad things did happen in theaters?
I wasn't... paying attention. Anyways, I brought back all of your friends, I think. Goodbye!
And just like that, the spirit of cinema disappears. And several others reappear.
Hey!
I got my voice back.
Hey, it's me, Casey.
But wait, who could have done this?
Craig nods, leans down, and pulls the mask from the dead man's face. But then the murderer's clothes deflate, his body made only of sand.
It's sand.
No, look.
Craig reaches down again, pulling a business card from the clothes.
Ah, yes, of course. It was cinema's true enemy. Civil War reenactments.
And thus, Secret Movie Club, minus Steven, who the spirit of cinema forgot to bring back, traveled the country, gaining power, spreading the word of anti-Civil War reenactment beliefs, passing laws banning Civil War reenactments, enforcing those laws with brutal strength, forcing those who wished to even discuss Civil War reenactments to whisper and hide and start underground secret societies. Freedom fighters dedicated to a future in which reenacting the Civil War is no longer denied by Big Brother. Well, I think that will be enough for tonight. I'm the 82nd clone of Hillary Clinton, wishing you a happy Halloween.
Yes, a happy Halloween to all you murderous men, witchy women, and nightmarish non-binaries. I have been Mr. Devil, and this has been my 30th anniversary Hall of Haunts, starring
Jackson Canning as
The Man,
Gus,
and Edwin.
Connor Lloyd Cruz as The Spirit of Cinema.
Gabrielle Galloway as the narrator for Seafog.
Edwin Gomez as Coast Guard Radio.
Craig Hamill as Pack Drill Operator.
Beverly Jean as the narrator for Night at the Club.
Emily Kirk as Sam and Finny.
Elise Metcalf as Charlotte.
Daniel Ott as Eddie.
Bill Watterson as the narrator for The Wheel and Lewis.
This episode of Secret Movie Club Radio Hour was written, directed, edited, and produced by Connor Lloyd Cruz. The Sleeping Mariner was written and directed by Craig Hamill. Seafog was written and directed by Daniel Ott. Sound recording and re-recording mixing by Jamie Hart. Original music by Andrew Kaiser. With additional music for The Wheel and Night at the Club by Connor Lloyd Cruz and for Seafog by Brian Robert. I'm Craig Hamill, the founder and programmer of Secret Movie Club. Thanks so much for spending some of your precious Halloween spooky time on our horror anthology. And join us this holiday season for our season finale, Secret Movie Club Radio Hour Episode 5, a two-part Western filled with double crosses, desperate characters, a race to collect a bounty, and a secret town of, well, you'll just have to listen to find out. You can find out about everything we do, including movie screenings, blogs, podcasts, movie posters, t-shirts, and everything cinema at secretmovieclub.com. Until then, watch great movies, tell great stories, and have a happy Halloween.
Craig, how's it going on your side? Is that boy still there?
I mean, let's just record it, and then you can cut it, and I can re-record it if we need to. I don't know what these people are doing. I mean, they're literally, it's Fast and Furious 11 out here, so.